This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's the third Thursday of the month, and this is a day on the Afternoon Magazine we devote each month to a discussion about computers and the online world. Today, we will have a discussion about the law and cyberspace. Our guest this afternoon, Stuart Beagle. He is a member of the faculty in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies and the School of Law at the University of California, Los Angeles. Stuart Beagle is also the author of Beyond Our Control, Confronting the Limits of Our Legal System in the Age of Cyberspace. The book includes information on some hot issues regarding the Internet, including free speech rights, intellectual property rights, cyber fraud, and cyber terrorism. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I invite your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Stuart Beagle's book, Beyond Our Control, is published by the MIT Press. Mr. Beagle, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Celeste. Glad to be here.
Yeah. In the book's introduction, you wrote, "The online world is not monolithic, but instead contains many different cyber spaces." I thought we might start here with the idea of just what is cyberspace, and would you explain what you mean when you say the online world contains many cyberspaces?
Well, for a long time, people were looking at the Internet as one thing, one entity. And when you actually think about how it's used, a lot of people have been analogizing to separate rooms or separate communities. Part of the online world might be a local, like a local pub. Another part might be a library. Another part is a red light district. And each of those parts may have different legal systems that would apply.
Now, the Internet has been likened to the Wild West. Is that image an accurate one?
Well, I play with that at length in the book. I find that more than ever it's an appropriate image, given the fact that the way the Internet was designed, it wasn't, for example, designed for electronic commerce at all. It was designed to be this distributed anarchic network that could withstand nuclear attack. And instead, it's evolved into something that a lot of people still believe is an efficient way to do business. It just, given that, there are so many aspects to it, that's why we go to the cyberspaces rather than simply one cyberspace.
Mm. You offer readers in the book a discussion of three Western films. One of them is Shane, which you say is the most appropriate metaphor for the online community. How so?
Well, Shane, a classic movie with Alan Ladd, you have this image of a very, very small community. And the debate between the cattlemen and the so-called sodbusters. You have the cattlemen who are able to drive their cattle across these open spaces, no fences in their way. And then you have these sodbusters, these folks, the farmers, coming out, building their fences, bringing so-called civilization with them, their families. And it's a classic confrontation that you arguably see in today's Internet because of the fact that the freedom we had at the beginning to use the Internet as we please may not be there in the same way today.
Mm. There are some interesting points of view about the online world that you present in Beyond Our Control. And I would like you to talk with us, if you would, about these three views that are put forth by three different men, Andrew Shapiro, Phil Agri, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, and John Perry Barlow. Who are these guys? And if you would, share with us their views regarding cyberspace.
Well, these folks are all scholars in their own right. they come from very different perspectives. Phil Agri is a traditional academic, colleague of mine, actually, at UCLA. Andrew Shapiro has been a fellow in public policy. And John Perry Barlow is a former lyricist for the Grateful Dead and on and off sheep farmer, I believe, in Wyoming. And they have different perspectives on where cyberspace might be placed in terms of how the law can or should apply.
Yeah. In the book, I don't know if you do you have the book with you?
Yes.
These views are discussed in pages 37 through 39, if that'll give you a hand, because I think this is a very interesting kind of, I want to examine these views a little bit, because I think that they get to some pretty interesting issues about jurisdiction and the laws that apply when we are in our cyberspaces. Andrew Shapiro, you write, for example, insists that we are not well served by the idea that cyberspace is an autonomous place.
Yeah, he has a slightly different view than a lot of other academics who have argued that cyberspace should be looked at differently and the law should treat it differently. One of the debates in recent years has been, to what extent is cyberspace different? To what extent should traditional laws apply? To what extent do we need new laws? And Shapiro argues that cyberspace is more of a locus of control rather than something that's out there.
Mm-hmm. It is connected to us here. It's not out there. It's both there and here.
Right. And it's an interesting metaphor. He and Agri seem to agree on the concept that given the fact that we're going to continue to be so interconnected, that we're moving more and more to wireless and to smaller and smaller information appliances, that the idea of cyberspace as something separate and apart is anachronistic.
Yeah. And Agri, he is interested in what he calls border problems. Can you explain that?
Well, you know, the reference in the book to his concern with the use of cyberspace is a utopian metaphor. But beyond that, he wonders where the borders of cyberspace are, given the fact that we're so interconnected. The borderless world of the Internet takes on a lot of interesting aspects in this debate. You have issues. Recently, last year, Yahoo was in court in France because of auctioning off Nazi memorabilia, apparently in violation of some of the laws in France. And a similar case with CompuServe in Munich, Germany, a few years before that. And so the question is, can one country dictate what the laws of cyberspace should be, if the internet comes through in that country? Can one country seek to have the internet blocked in its country to the extent that that portion of the internet is violative of its laws?
Mm-hmm.
So what Agri's talking about is, and what you're referencing, is a gigantic issue that's still unresolved.
Right, and Barlow's views are also interesting about cyberspace, and he also addresses this issue of borders. The quote that you have in the book begins, "Cyberspace does not lie within your borders."
Yes, that's his famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, and he's talking to the so-called corporate world or powers that be. He takes a very populist view of the Internet and is very famous for another article in Wired magazine where he claims that information wants to be free and argues that there should be no intellectual property laws essentially at all on the Internet, that it's irrelevant on the Internet.
So how is all this stuff being sorted out as to who has jurisdiction and what laws apply.
How is this being sorted out?
Yeah.
Well, you have, in the United States, actually, we've come to some sort of a generic formula as far as state to state. There was a big issue in the mid-90s. What happens if you're in one state and you're accessing the Internet in another, and the different states have different laws? There's some sort of a generic formula that the federal courts have evolved to deal with basic situations, and that seems to have receded as a major issue. But on the international level, as I suggested, that's still wide open territory. And one of the questions is, technically, can you really block a portion of the Internet from coming into your country? That's an unresolved issue. There's a debate among the techies on that one.
Hmm. To what extent is the Internet regulated today?
Well, that's another interesting question that we look at. To what extent is the Internet regulated today? I argue that it's very regulated, that contrary to what may be popular belief, not only are there a lot of traditional laws that apply depending on the situation, but you have Congress passing some significant legislation in recent years, ranging from intellectual property to the use of filtering if you receive money in schools and libraries. And then you have state legislators passing their laws as well. So there are laws all over the place. There is a tremendous amount of case law and case decisions that have come down in recent years that set forth principles that apply in cyberspace. And then there are other forms of regulation through structuring the architecture. In one of our chapters, we look at the changing of the architecture of the Internet as a form of regulation.
Now, explain what you mean by that, the architecture of cyberspace, and how can you build cyberspace so as to regulate it?
Well, the thing that we need to realize, and my friend Larry Lessig, a professor at Stanford, has argued the same in his work, is that cyberspace is not bricks and mortar. It's constructed out of software code. And if you change the software code, you change the reality. There are a lot of things that could be done, for example, in the way an Internet browser is structured. The current Internet browsers that people use, basically Internet Explorer and Netscape, allow you a tremendous amount of freedom to copy files, to access information. If those are restructured in certain ways, you may not be able to so easily copy material from other websites or send or distribute or share, as the word is used, MP3 files. It all depends on how those protocols are set up.
Another example would be a firewall or firewalls.
Exactly. And as I point out, individuals can regulate their own portion of cyberspace as well through firewalls, through the way they configure maybe some level of filtering on their site. Companies can defend against cyber attacks through software, and that changes the architecture of their portion of cyberspace.
Mm.
So some people see that as a form of self-regulation that may be more appropriate depending on what's going on, but it is regulation nonetheless.
This was very interesting to me in your book, the players that are involved in regulating the Internet. There are quite a few. Who are the most important?
Well, we spend a whole chapter on that. There are, of course, the government, I would argue, is still the most important, even though the government is always saying, well, we're not in charge. And sometimes you hear from government officials, no one's in charge. In reality, the United States government basically had a major hand in creating the Internet and fostering its growth and development. laws that are passed by the government and by governments in other countries impact the Internet. You have the Federal Trade Commission, the FCC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, very aggressive in cyberspace. You have the FBI, the Department of Justice, very aggressive in cyberspace. To say that the government is not involved, you feel so free and easy when you enter online that, you may not think that the government's involved, but they're involved on so many levels that I think, you know, I would say they're the most important player today, especially the U.S. government.
Are they the custodians of the backbone of the Internet?
Well, they say no. You know, you have this very interesting interrelationship. Just as the Internet is, itself is distributed and anarchic, you have almost this distributed anarchic balance between the government, between the IT industry, to the extent that the phone companies may not be part of the IT industry. You have that going on. You have the cable companies. You have Microsoft, which some feel that Microsoft may still be the most important, single most important entity outside the government. So you have these different groups. The colleges and universities have receded. They were at one point probably a more important player in the earlier days of the Internet. And then you have the commercial interests. The major companies that have commercial interests online are still players in this. And this is sort of an uneasy ongoing interrelationship. Then you have these disputes. U.S. government has had this ongoing dispute with Microsoft, for example.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Stuart Beagle is our guest this afternoon. He's a member of the faculty in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies and the School of Law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He is also the author of Beyond Our Control, Confronting the Limits of Our Legal System in the Age of Cyberspace. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. Your questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, the number to call in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Stuart Beagle's book, Beyond Our Control, is published by the MIT Press. We've got a listener who's coming in here, and before I get launched on another question, we're going to go to this caller who's now waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just wondering if the guest had anything to say about Opera, one of the new browsers that's appeared.
Well, what you know, it's always interesting to see new browsers. They don't tend to have the same attention and the same level of use as the more popular ones, but with new browsers, you sometimes have a level of freedom even greater than the original. Is there an aspect of Opera in particular that you're interested in?
Well, the caller isn't with us. I don't know whether he hung up or if we got disconnected. But I've not heard of this browser Opera.
Yeah, they have. There are always companies that are. Proposing alternate browsers, and sometimes they're more restrictive, but as a general rule, they tend to give the user more freedom, and so other issues come up. But, you know, given the way cyberspace is structured, the way, for example, that Internet Explorer is bundled with, or that's a debate to the extent that it is bundled with the operating system that you get when you get a Windows computer. So many people use that as a matter of course. It's hard to start a new operating a system like that.
Other calls are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have seen the great battle over copyright issues on the net. We've heard or may have been affected by scams where credit card numbers have been stolen. And we've also seen people prosecuted for putting viruses out on the net for hacking. And we've seen pedophiles arrested, tried, and sent to prison for their activities online. So the law, we can see by these activities, the law is active in cyberspace. Are there other examples of the law in cyberspace that you'd like to address, Stuart Bagel?
Well, I think you had mentioned some of the cyber security issues. At this point in time, I think the issue of cyber terrorism is a very interesting one. The issue of how the Internet might be changing in the aftermath of September 11th is a concurrent matter of interest. I noticed the last few days several people have mentioned that they're feeling safer using email than they are using traditional snail mail, given the anthrax scares. So you have that aspect coming into play, where a few months ago people were saying they feel less safe on the Internet. They're concerned about a lack of privacy. Now people are looking to the Internet as this system designed to withstand nuclear attack that we can rely on in difficult times. But then at the same time, people are paying more attention to reports that were issued in the late 90s that warned about some of the weak points of the Internet with regard to possible cyber attacks and cyber terrorism.
Yeah. You remind folks in your book that President Clinton addressed the issue briefly in a State of the Union address.
Yes, he did. In 1999, he called for more funds, specifically, quote, to defend the U.S. from threats to critical computer networks by combating terrorism and protecting the infrastructures. In 1997, the President's Commission on Critical Infrastructure came out with a major report documenting some of the concerns, and I think they ring especially true today. And I know that President Bush has recently appointed a gentleman to explicitly focus on this area, Richard Clark.
Mm. Now, these concerns, then, have been around for a couple of years, which, when we talk about Internet, and we talk about time and the Internet, that's some time.
Oh, yeah.
Has action been taken to avoid disasters in cyberspace?
Well, what's interesting is there was a sense that, well, things are generally going okay. You had some distributed attacks that cost some companies a lot of money, and those are still a concern. But it's almost like you look back at the FAA, the warnings that were set forth in that regard that weren't heeded and weren't paid a whole lot of attention to until we had those hijackings last month. It's the same sort of pattern I think you see with the Internet. There really hasn't been a whole lot of change, if any, since those warnings were set forth in 1997.
What kind of effort would be needed to lessen our vulnerability?
Well, one of the things they need to look at is the aspect of the online world that most of us have nothing to do with, where things like computerized power grids, for example, or hospital data are or can be controlled through computer networks. That's an aspect where there's a level of vulnerability a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah.
Another aspect, and this is one of the things that has changed in recent weeks, is that a lot of sensitive data in terms of building plans has been removed from the Internet since September 11th out of concern for terrorist attacks. One of the dangers, of course, from a lot of people's perspective is that information that we thought we had access to, we may not have as much access to as a result of what's been going on.
In the book, you quote, hackers who have boasted that they could shut down the internet in half an hour. You think that's, are we that vulnerable?
Well, that was a May 1998 U.S. Senate committee hearing, and that was a debate. Some people said, yes, we are that vulnerable to a few hackers, few good hackers anyway. Others thought that might be somewhat of an overstatement, a level of bragging when they were in the public eye. The Internet is not easily shut down. It's designed in such a way that it's not easily shut down. For example, one of the questions is, can the United States, which essentially started the Internet, shut the Internet down if it wanted to? The answer is we could probably do a pretty good job of limiting Internet communication if we really wanted to, but to actually shut a network like this down completely, which depends on so many other computers which are now all over the world, we would probably not be able to completely shut it down. And if the U.S. government cannot completely shut it down, then I'm suspecting that individual hackers, they could have a great impact, but I don't think it could be completely shut down.
Could the government shut down the Internet in just one portion of the world or in one portion of the country?
Well, you know, to the extent that the government declared martial law, and as part of the martial law, it determined that the Internet being available was a danger. It could have a great amount of impact on the Internet service providers in the United States, which constitute the bulk of Internet service providers worldwide. But even in the United States, you'll have folks who are operating their own computers and having their own networks, and you're going to have anarchic activity going on even in the United States, even in something like that.
Hmm. Online fraud has been a concern. How big a problem is online fraud?
Well, that actually, I think, is less of a problem than some of these other areas. That's not to say that there isn't online fraud happening even as we speak, but it doesn't appear to be a whole lot different from what goes on offline, and that's what's been going on from time immemorial. So I think when we talk about cyberspace problems, we're generally looking at areas that are unique to cyberspace, and online fraud is not particularly unique to cyberspace in most cases.
Hmm. There was quite a heist, if you will, that you report on in the book that some folks managed through using their computers to get themselves set up with some luxury cars.
Yes. There's so many different kinds of schemes and scams that people come up with, and I don't mean to make light of it. This is a big issue, but the FTC, U.S. FTC, has focused heavily on this, and I believe they've made significant inroads and have set up a system where you can contact them through their website, and they seem to continue to be very aggressive, even with the change in administration, and focusing on these things.
Mm. Also, in the book, you talk a little bit about online stock fraud and the volume of complaints that the SEC, the Security and Exchange Commission, receives. Able to handle those complaints?
Well, that's an area that it hasn't been in the news much lately. Of course, there are less folks sitting at their computers and buying and selling stocks than there were when the market was doing a little better. But you still have this problem of people going into chat rooms, for example, and trying to pump up the price of a stock or drive it down, and in that way violating laws in that area. So that's an ongoing problem.
And
there's no easy solution.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the case of Jonathan Lebed?
The young man in
New Jersey?
Yeah.
Yeah, he made a lot of money trading on the internet, and then the SEC said, no, 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 you can't do that. And the question is, you know, was he manipulating the market, or, you know, was he doing what traders do? You know, did he know an undervalued stock when he saw it?
Yes, and he was very young, and he had a lot of sympathy, and I believe there was a cover story on him in the New York Times magazine, which wasn't particularly critical of him at all. In fact, painted him to be some sort of Horatio Alger figure. This is, you know, there are a lot of gray areas there in terms of driving stock prices up or down, and that's an issue offline as well. You go to a cocktail party and you drop a hint about a certain stock, and in the back of your mind you're thinking of what you're going to buy or sell the next day. At what point does that constitute a violation of the law? At what point is that just Americans going about their entrepreneurial affairs?
Speaking of business and the net, we haven't really talked about MP3 files. Court decisions now have come down in favor of the recording companies on this issue. Has that put an end to the exchange of these kind of files?
Well, a lot of people think of Napster, for example, as old news, and that's understandable because Napster is basically not operating right now. But a lot of people are still trading music files through Music City, the Nutella network, and in an even more anarchic way than they did with Napster, because it's not going through the central server of any particular company. And given that, it may be much harder for the record companies to prevail in the end. I think that they're less concerned because the volume of users that we saw with Napster is not the same on some of these other services. But there's a lot going on still. People, you can go online this afternoon and get basically any fairly well-known song you want, especially if you have a good DSL connection, in a very short time, and it'll be there for you.
Yeah. So it looks like Barlow's view is prevailing here.
It's going to be, you know, that issue has not gone away. It's off the front pages, but it has not gone away.
The issue of privacy has been an ongoing concern online as well. Maybe you would talk with us for a little bit here about where we stand today in terms of the privacy issue.
Well, that is, as I referenced earlier, a major concern of a lot of people, and even more so in light of the legislation that was proposed by Attorney General Ashcroft after September 11th, which increases the ability of the government to conduct what's been called cyber surveillance. That legislation has not come through in the end. Versions of it have been passed by the Senate and the House, but they have to meet to see if they can reconcile the differences and then have a final vote. But privacy online, we don't have a whole lot of privacy online. We can be tracked all over the place, and even if we delete our email files, they can be found on backups that most providers make. We don't have a whole lot of privacy rights in this country in general, contrary to popular belief, online or offline. It's really remarkable.
Yesterday, or the day before it might have been now, our Attorney General here in the state of Illinois, Jim Ryan, proposed some new legislation that would get at some of these issues, the same issues that we've been talking about here and that the U.S. Attorney General has been talking about. And I'm wondering, you know, will we see the states become actively involved in passing laws to change the situation regarding, you know, what can be surveilled and when and why and so on and so forth.
Right, right. Well, you always have that going on where states are working on concurrent versions of what's happening at the federal level or vice versa. That's the way our legal system is set up. But then the question is, with cyberspace, is it relevant for or appropriate for states to be passing laws that impact the Internet, given the borderless nature of it? A lot of people feel that, given that, the federal governments are the more appropriate venue for that.
Yeah. By way of illustration on this issue, there's a case that you talk about in the book that involved a couple in California who were had a BBS that was offering pornography. And they were charged, I believe, in Tennessee?
Yes.
Maybe yes, you'd talk with us about that case. That kind of illustrates what we've been talking about, I think, a little bit.
It's a classic case, U.S. v. Thomas, one of the first true cyber law cases of the mid-90s. They were operating a pornography business out of their bedroom in Northern California, in the Bay Area, with two computers, and they were taking in $200,000 a year through this bulletin board service, which is an earlier technology that's not typically used anymore. But the question then is, were they distributing these pictures in violation of the obscenity laws? You're not allowed to distribute obscene material across state lines. And the question then was the material obscene? Our definition of obscenity under U.S. law is that it's based on contemporary community standards. So what's obscene in one part of the country is arguably not obscene in another part. So here they are in the Bay Area, where a lot of people think anything goes, and maybe the material was not obscene in the San Francisco Bay Area, but in the Bible Belt in Tennessee, it was definitely determined to be obscene. So the Thomases were hauled into federal court in Tennessee from their home in California. They were convicted in Tennessee, and they served jail time.
Well, very, very interesting case.
Very interesting. And those issues are not resolved.
Yeah. There's so many. There's so many issues. And the Internet is always changing.
It sure is. And I see it changing again, as I indicated in recent weeks.
Yeah. Stuart Beagle, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Maybe as we go along, we'll check back with you and find out what's happening.
That would be my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Stuart Beagle has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is a member of the faculty in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies and the School of Law at UCLA. He's also the author of Beyond Our Control: Confronting the Limits of Our Legal System in the Age of Cyberspace. Beyond Our Control is followed by a big question mark. Very interesting reading. Beyond Our Control is published by the MIT Press.